Kaya FM 95.9. The Law Report with Michael Mutwining Bill on Kaya FM 95.9.
Good evening and welcome to the Law Report. My name is Michael Mutwining Bill. Thank you so much, Sutumeya. She's back again tomorrow. What are we talking about tonight? We're talking about intellectual property. Do you have a business? You have business ideas that you want to pitch somewhere? You have ideas that you've come up with? You want to make sure that nobody takes them away from you? You produce music. You want to make sure that it remains your music and you get paid for it? This is a show to listen to. Give us a call, 086-000-959.
The Law Report on Kaya FM 95.9.
All right, I'm so excited to be talking about this show because, you know, just the other day, in fact, for the last couple of months, we've been, amongst many things that we've been doing, celebrating Master KG and his song Jerusalem. We've seen various videos of it in different countries. Just everybody just sharing in I want to say, our music, because he's, you know, Master KG is our person and therefore it's our music. And when you see that, you see a representation of yourself as both an African and as a South African. So that was quite exciting. But there's another part to all of that excitement, which is the legal issues that surround that. And one of the things that we're going to be talking about is talking to Master KG's lawyer and talking about some of the legalities that have arisen from all of that thing that I've described as being so beautiful. So that's the first part. But I know a lot of you guys are sitting at home and you're coming up with ideas and you're saying, you know, I want to do this and I want to do that. And for many of you, you might be concerned, but if I start this, if I tell the world that this is what I have in mind, they'll start copying me. And I don't want my idea to be copied. What kind of ideas can be protected from being copied? What qualifies? What makes an idea patentable or what makes your logo or your name trademarkable? And I know I'm making sort of words up here as I go, trademarkable, or even copyrightable. So that's really what we want to talk about. And I think this is the topic that is most important because this is a time for creating. I mean, if you look at people that are making money in the world, those are the people that are creating stuff. And their currency is pretty much ideas. So I want to hear from you. I want to hear what you have in mind and what are your fears? What are your concerns? What are you thinking about in terms of, you know, ideas and that can be protected? I'm talking to three great lawyers that are going to be taking us through some of these things. And maybe let me start by welcoming my first guest, at Stephen Halls. He's a partner and trademark attorney at Adams & Adams. Stephen, thank you so much for talking to me. Are you well?
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much for having me. Yes, looking forward to the conversation. Very important stuff.
Whilst I wait for my other guest to join, here's maybe, you know, when we talk about intellectual property, you and I might readily understand what that means, but I mean, maybe let's just, you know, as an opener or a preamble, what is intellectual property and what are the, you know, subcategories of intellectual property?
Michael, you're quite right. I find sometimes that the word is such a lofty term that it tends to take all the fun out of it for most people. So intellectual property, you know, if one were to describe it, you could say that it's property rights in law that are basically that attach to certain creations and materializations of the human mind. So it's something that you have to come up with. It's a protectable invention. It's a brand, a distinctive brand that you might originate and adopt for your products and services. It can also be a distinctive design. For instance, if a fashion designer came out with a new, a certain, a very unique style of design for whether clothes or a new couch, it can be different things. Mm. And then also, of course, you've got copyright, which will probably get a lot of mention on your show tonight. Where you can actually protect certain material expressions. Now, one thing to bear in mind is that there's no intrinsic protection in law for ideas as ideas. Mm. So if you want to protect an idea, you have to do something with it. You have to bring it into materialize it. Now, It's a little bit different with patents, because with patents you deal with an invention. So there you sort of protect a certain methodology, a certain way that something works or that you make. But with insofar as copyright is concerned, and because I presume tonight's show will be quite focused on music as well, you know, if I sit next to you on the Gautrain and you tell me on the way to the airport that you've got a great idea for a new song, and you hum a melody to me, if you don't do anything with that song, if you don't notate it, if you don't put it down in any material form, and I get to my destination, and by the time I've taken my flight and I land, I've written the song, I've notated it, I've created a song before you, if that makes sense. So it's important to understand that when you are creative, you have to do something with it. You have to put it down in material form. And insofar as something like an invention is concerned, the most important thing would be not to disclose it before you've actually taken some legal advice to determine whether it could be protected under patent law. Because if you disclose an invention that you come up with before you file your patent, you could actually ruin your the patentability of that invention. But as a basic rule, if you're going to adopt and select a new trademark, a new brand, whether you're a musician for your album, whether a person who writes books, whether you're actually somebody who brings out a new product or a service, decide on a distinctive brand, something that doesn't directly describe the products and services. Think of Jaguar for a car. It cleverly alludes to some of those characteristics that are nice about a car, that's sleek and powerful and rare and beautiful. And for copyright, be original. Don't copy anyone else. Come up with your and where you feel you've got something, go and see a lawyer, go and see an intellectual property lawyer to see that you're properly covered from the beginning.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking intellectual property, and I'm joined on the line by Stephen Hollers. And joining me also now is Chola Makamate. Chola is with Samro. Chola, good evening, and thank you very much. I'm so excited to be talking to you. It's been a while.
Good evening, Michael. Good to hear your voice after a long time.
Oh, that means you don't listen to the Law Report. You should, because my voice is on the wireless every week.
I mean, personally speaking to you, although it
you just been caught out. Anyway, I mean, we talk about Samro. We've spoken to Samro before, but for those of us that don't know who and what Samro is, what is Samro?
So Samro is what we call a collective management organization, right? And I'm just going to try and keep it as simple as possible because we, you know, could go into a lot of detail about this. Stephen spoke about copyright, and we get our mandate essentially from the Copyright Act.
Yeah.
And our role really is we are, simply put, the middleman between the creators of music and literary works, mm-hmm. and the creators and the users, on the other hand, who require licenses in order to use those literary and musical works so that we can then pay over the royalties to creators who are our members. So essentially put, we're just in the middle assisting with administration of the rights of creators and ensuring that we get the money in and it's paid over to them.
And let me also just welcome Dumisani Motsamai. Dumisani is an attorney at Morolong Incorporated. Dumisani, thank you very much for joining us and welcome. All right, I see there might be a little bit of an issue with Dumisani's line. But we'll attend to it. Let me just turn to you, and you raised something interesting, Stephen, when you were talking about and really we're hoping to focus a little bit broader than just copyright, because you know intellectual property we have people listening with varying interests, and something that you mentioned earlier, you were talking about an idea, a fashion idea, and as you said that, I thought immediately of the brand Makosa. And because when you take Makosa on the one hand, and then you take South Africa or African attire, and every country seems to identify with a particular pattern. There's one for Basotho, there's one for Ghana, there's a variety. When you take something like that, where you can't readily identify who owns it, What would the legal position be if some Swiss company started using Ghanaian materials to make proper money?
Well, Michael, that's a great question, and we have seen instances where prominent international brands have looked to do exactly that, that's why it's very important. If there is an original design but in this case, what you're talking about is more design that can actually be traced back to indigenous knowledge systems. The world has been a bit slow on this, not only in South Africa and perhaps Africa, but the world is catching on fast by enacting new legal frameworks. Like in South Africa, we've got the Traditional Knowledge Bill, for instance, or the Traditional Knowledge Act. And what it does is it creates systems through which you can, as indigenous community, establish some statutory protection for those kinds of rights. That can't be traced back to a particular owner, but rather to a particular community. Mm. So that if somebody were to, if, for instance, a foreign or an international fashion house were to be interested in using the same kind of patterns, that can easily be traced back, or the fabrics and so forth, and patterns, traced back to a particular indigenous community, that they need to deal with those rights holders. And that's where collective rights management, that Chola also mentioned in the music business, it's something similar to that. So you have to set up a system to ensure that the people who are interested to use the protected work know where to go to get permission for the use, and so that if they pay their license fees, that the license fees are then collected and distributed in accordance with the mandate of the rights holders, whether they are creatives and musicians and record labels on the one hand in the music business, or the traditional knowledge, the indigenous communities and their traditional leaders on the other. So it's a very important thing. Developments are constantly evolving on that front, and lawmakers are still in the process of catching up a little bit, but that is being addressed.
And maybe just turn, I mean, my producer posed a question to me, Chola, and she asked, Masego asked, what happens to the music where you find yourself in a mall or you find yourself in a restaurant and music is playing? What becomes because obviously it contributes to the ambience of that particular restaurant or that mall. Do the artists benefit in that situation?
Absolutely, they do. Yes. Yeah. Sorry, Chola, you can go with this one.
Yeah, they do. So our role, really, like I said, is to license users, and there are a plethora of users. Yeah. We have broadcasters like yourselves. We've got restaurants. We've got malls. Anywhere, really, where music is being used, they could obtain a license from the requisite, and depending on the rights, because in the Copyright Act, you have different works that require protection, and those different works attract a particular bundle of rights. Also, depending on the bundle of rights that are attracted for the work, you're required to get a particular license. And in this space that Samo is in, there are a number of other similar types of organizations that administer particular rights. So, so for instance, if a restaurant is playing music, what will happen is that an organization like SAMO would then license them for the use of the works, particularly our members' repertoire, because remember, SAMO does not represent everybody. So in order for us to represent you and to administer your works, you have to be a member of SAMO. That gives us the mandate, and you empower us to then go and license users, and then they in turn as users provide us with what we call usage reports, so we understand which works are being used. They give us those reports, we administer the works, and we use that information for distribution ultimately to our members. So if you are using our members' works, particularly for public performance, so private use is a different issue, but for public performance, for commercial use, you must have a license, depending on the rights accruing to those works and the mandates that have been given to the CMO. You must have a license so that you can then administer those the information required to then distribute the money to the creators who created the work.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking intellectual property, and joining me on the line are Chalama Khamate. Chalama Khamate is with Samro, as well as Stephen Hollis. He's a partner and trademark attorney at Adams & Adams. Perhaps this question is more suited for you, Stephen. When we're talking trademarks, I mean, we've spoken a little bit about copyright, but what distinguishes a copyright from a trademark?
Well, a trademark, so something to also understand about intellectual property and statutory forms of intellectual property. You've basically got an underlying act or piece of legislation. So with trademarks, you've got what you call a Trademarks Act, and with copyright, you've got a Copyright Act.
Okay.
And these pieces of legislation will be very specifically deal with different forms of intellectual property. So you've got, you've also got a Designs Act, and you've got a Patents Act. So when dealing with trademarks, the Trademarks Act will tell you which trademarks are capable of being protected, registrable. In terms of the Trademarks Act, at which point, once you achieve a registration, quite powerful statutory rights are secured for the rights owner, for the owner of the brand, which allows them to really enforce that their statutory rights against third parties and prevent third parties from using the same brand or a similar brand in respect of the same or competing goods or services in trade. So with trademarks, a brand is one of the most powerful business assets that a company can have. Mm-hmm. It's also the only form of statutory IP protection that you can keep alive forever if you renew it every 10 years. Most forms of statutory IP, you can only keep alive for a limited period of time. But with a brand, you can actually establish a real, let's call it a competitive advantage by making sure that no third party out there in the countries where you've got a brand registered can use even a similar mark, something that sounds similar or means something similar or it's visually similar. So it does create a unique opportunity for a brand owner with a very distinctive brand to really, mark down his or her territory.
Mm.
A copyright, on the other hand, is, is a statutory, is very powerful statutory rights conferred on the creator of works, predominantly. So where we're dealing with the trademark, which is more the label that you attach to your products and services, copyright really deals with the rights arising in certain types of original works that are created by the author.
Mm.
And what do those rights mean? And in a nutshell, it basically, prescribes or ascribes very powerful exclusive rights for the author, the person who originates the work, to exclusively control the commercialization of the work. So to have rights, for instance, it's a bundle of rights. It's not just one right.
Mm.
So that will include the right to exclusively make copies of the work, to reproduce it, the right to distribute it, the right to make it available to the public, the right to make it available for, to actually... if you think about music and what makes it quite complex in the music business is when you've got a piece of recorded music, there could be multiple copyright owners involved.
Mm.
So on the one hand, you could have somebody the person who originated the lyrics would own the copyright in the lyrics.
Mm.
The person who wrote the music could own the copyright in the music. And the record label who recorded the song owns the copyright in the in the sound recording, in the master recordings. So you have these you potentially different rights holders, and that's where it becomes so important for the role for collective rights management organizations like SAMRO to assist with the administration of those rights, those exclusive commercialization rights. They receive a mandate on by the artists, and also SAMPRA also look after the rights of record labels in a similar way.
Mm.
So if music is played on the radio or played in a store, like you said, to create an ambiance, or in a gym or in a coffee shop. Anyone who makes use of recorded music as a company or a business are very well aware that it's necessary to make sure that they are licensed to do so at their premises. Otherwise, they infringe on those potentially on those exclusive rights, and ultimately the license fees benefit the artists and creators and also the companies that invest in them.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we continue our conversation talking intellectual property.
The Law Report with Michael Motsoeneng-Bell on Kaya FM 95.9.
Welcome back to the Law Report. I'm having a conversation with Stephen Hollis, a partner and trademark attorney at Adams & Adams, as well as Chola Makhamate, GM Legal Services at Samro. Joining me now on the line is Dumisani Motsamai, also an attorney, but also what's most interesting is, you'll remember in my introduction, I mentioned the celebrated song Jerusalem by Master KG. So he represents Master KG, and is an attorney at Morolong Incorporated. Ndata Motsamai, good evening.
Hi, Michael. How are you? Hi to Chola. Hi to Hollis.
Hi. Okay. Hi. So, I mean, we were all proud at, you know, seeing big names globally and big brands using Jerusalem to celebrate, to market their products, to pretty much sort of spread messages of hope or of joy and whatever the case might have been. And that was sort of what I described in my introduction as a moment of pride for many of us. But there's another side of this, which is the legal side. Talk to us about what you're doing for Master KG.
Yes. Look, Hollis introduced this topic quite very well about what's protected in terms of the copyright and the different copyrights that are involved in music, in terms of the lyrics, in terms of the music, and in terms of the sound. And in this particular instance, our partners really, Warner International, already started licensing what they perceived as straight ads and straight sync arising from the song. And all that we're doing really is at Open Mic, which is the company where Master KG and Nomto were signed, is to roll out that same process really in Africa, in the sub-Sahara, so to say.
And we understand that you are instituting various legal proceedings with a view to ensure that there is a proper recovery of royalties.
Yes. So, the issue here is that some of these companies, they took it a little bit more than just a challenge, you know, a good to have kind of a moment and fun, really. And, you will find this quite funny, Michael, but some of these companies that were discovering the outlaying marketing budget to make their challenge an ad, really. And they were employing marketing agencies to come and make sure that their challenge, you know, becomes a top-notch challenge. And whenever they put it in the social media, they will boost their pages their ads on the various social media platforms. So you can see that these are people that are going out of their way, really, to ambush the challenge and make ads. You know, so what we're doing, as you correctly said, is that we and our approach really is the same as the Warner approach, in the sense that we it's not necessarily adversarial. What we're doing is we're approaching companies and we're assuming really we are departing from a point of view that they may have not known that they've skipped the line. And we are targeting specifically those that went out of their way to make ads out of their song, and we're saying, guys, let's talk. You used our song in a sync. This is what we expect. Let's have a conversation.
And how's that going? I imagine it's quite a big job, because it's not like you're approaching a company down the road in Santon. It's sort of a global endeavor, isn't it?
Yeah. Look, I think after the media took it up, you know, last week, it started getting momentum than it had been doing prior to that. It's funny, we're getting messages from former employees of some of these companies detailing how the campaign on their end was unfolding. We are getting some companies that says, you know, we did this, but we will tell you others who also did it. And of course, we are getting people that are busy deleting their videos on YouTube, which is, I'm not sure how useful that is. I mean, there is fingerprint identification in this thing. And it's not like we started this thing now. I mean, it's been a good month that we've been reviewing this video. So we've got all these videos. Deleting it now doesn't really help.
Sure. It sounds like a hell of a job. I'm thinking, and maybe Trot, I wanted to come back to you on this. I mean, when you think about music in South Africa, right? Music moves. It almost moves literally as at the speed of light or even sound. These days, with, you know, I can produce something and it could be with the speed of sound be you know, across seven oceans. So enforcement. So I am, you know, DJ Mike, and I've produced a song and here's something happening in Germany. What are some of the things that you do for me, if any, if I'm your member, and with my music being broadcast, globally?
So look, enforcement is an interesting space, particularly in the digital age. What we try to do, as an organization like SAMRO, is that we enter into agreements with sister societies in other jurisdictions who then assist us with administering the works with users there and administering license agreements there, so that we can then be paid over the monies for our members here in South Africa. So we have those type of bilateral agreements in place.
Mm.
But as you are aware, different jurisdictions have different levels of protection for creators. And also different jurisdictions will have different provisions in their law regarding what can be determined as fair use or authorized use of works. So it is quite tricky, but I think for the most part, where you are organized, where you have adequate representation, and where you're able to find parties that can assist you in terms of enforcing your rights as a creator, you're a better place. So for somebody like Master KG, he's got lawyers here, he's got representation here, he's got international representation who are able to deal with the unauthorized use of his works. Now, obviously, depending on the jurisdiction, there are different defenses to that, one of them being something called fair use, which is predominantly used in the U.S., and something that our lawmakers are actually trying to introduce into our legislation, but it goes even beyond what is in the U.S. legislation. It also doesn't have the accompanying punitive damages, statutory damages that are inherent in the U.S. legislation. So, you know, you just need to be in a position really where you are adequately aware of your rights. You need to be aware of what you need to do in order to protect yourself, get the right representation if you can do so, and be alert at all times, because you can release something and it goes viral and it's unauthorized use in all corners of the universe, and you will find yourself, because you don't have the protection and the resources to enforce your rights. And that really is an unfortunate situation that a lot of creators find themselves in. I think Master KG is very fortunate that he does have the support that he has in order to enforce his rights in multiple jurisdictions.
I mean, let's talk about these bilateral agreements that you referred to. And we know that American music pretty much dominates the airwaves. My brother, who was formerly at SABC, I joke, had a big issue with this, and he had a 90% rule for local music. But we know that international music is big in South Africa. What's your role as SAMRO as regards Lionel Richie's song, for example?
So the issue really, Michael, is the broadcasters, right?
Mm.
Because we pay we collect on usage.
Mm.
So if your work is not used, we can't collect and we can't pay zero from zero.
Mm.
So I think that the users and the broadcasters need to come to the party and play more local content. There are quotas, obviously, as prescribed by ICASA, but there is a big push to have you know, those quotas made higher, because people are using South African music. They are. They're enjoying it a lot more. We've seen the trends with ourselves with Samo that we're.
It's a lot more varied. I mean, but, you know, honestly speaking, you spoil for choice these days, yeah, as well. Yeah. But my real question was more on, you know, so we got a picture of what happens from, I'm your member and I'm based in South Africa, what happens to my music when it's been played overseas? And you talked about bilateral agreement that you have with other collection societies. What happens with, you know, American music being played here? Do you have a role insofar as that is concerned as SAMRO arising from your bilateral agreement?
So this is where creatives need to be astute, because ultimately this is a marketing game, right? Your product, people need to know what your product is. You need to be able to market it. The same thing with music. If you want to penetrate market and get market share in different territories, you have to be able to get your product out there and get users using it and broadcasting it, because that's how you're going to get played. Mm-hmm. So who's your manager? Who's your promoter? Who's dealing with your marketing? And that's why a lot of people usually want to go with the big publishing houses, big record labels, because they have the budget to put towards things like that, where you can get your music heard in other countries. And once that's happening and there's usage, then our bilateral agreements are easy to enforce in that regard, because those users in those territories give those reports to those CMOs in those territories, who then collect and then pay over to us, and then we're able to pay to you.
Mm. So now let's talk about, you know, Dumzane, if I can bring you back, when we're talking about, you know, the same, still on the same theme about sort of enforcement across countries. Do you depend on these various countries subscribing to whatever treaty? I'm moving from the premise that not everybody could be bound by the same laws.
Well, so far as performance realities, yes, but in relation to this, the reality that is involving the particular action that we have embarked on, not necessarily, because it's something that that falls outside of the CMO regulation. But so far as the other, for example, public broadcast realities, most definitely, the collateral agreements that Chola is talking about come in very, very handy. Even the international partners that we use to distribute our music in the international market rely largely on them, you know, to be able to ensure that, you know, the realities for the performance of the song filters down to the composers and the publishers in South Africa.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking intellectual property, and joining me on the line are Stephen Hollis, who's a partner at Adams & Adams, Dumzane Motsamai, an attorney at Morolong Incorporated, as well as Chola Makgamate, who's a general manager legal services at SAMRO. If you have any questions for my guests, you want to start a business, you have some designs that you would like to get registered or protected, do you give us a call? The number to dial, 086-000-00959. So Stephen, we touched a little bit on, and I think, you know, you explained the bit about copyright, the bit about trademark, and you alluded to the Designs Act. And let's talk about, you know, that bit about what would then elevate a design to one that is capable of protection.
Well, with designs, Michael, you're looking at something that's really original. It's not commonplace. It's something that involves a degree of originality that sets it apart from what's already out there.
Mm.
So it depends. It's got to be something that's not part of what they call the state of the arts, and it has to introduce something new and original.
Mm.
Now, Michael, before we actually get to your guest questions, I was just thinking as Dumzane and Chola was also speaking, you know, when you discuss matters where intellectual property considerations are concerned, quite often the different areas of intellectual property find an overlap.
Mm.
So you'll find in this matter with Master KG that not only do you have the issues of copyright to consider, because clearly the, you know, what members of the public might wonder is where, what basis is there a claim, a legal claim for royalties, for usage fees?
Mm.
And that's, of course, rooted in copyright, as we discussed.
Mm.
Now, you also have considerations with respect to branding. And Dumisani mentioned that important point that, you know, once you actually start having companies taking advantage for their brands, you know, it takes years of investment and risk, financial risk, and clever marketing strategies to get your brand recognized. And when you get a movement like this phenomenal worldwide movement that the song originated in the dance challenge, there's a commercial opportunity for companies to align their brands with this movement and instantaneously tap into that massive global interest in the movement, right? Now, I saw today that I think the Jerusalem, you know, the dance challenge has had something like 344 million views around the world. Now, if you can tap into that for any business or company, that is immediate commercial value. Now, in this matter, and that's how intellectual property shows an overlap. So all of a sudden, there's branding and trademark law angles. There's unfair competition angles because somebody's actually benefiting from your goodwill, from your you know, movement that they didn't have any involvement in starting. So you can almost, it's not exactly the same, but you can almost think about a massive global event, like, for instance, a World Cup that attracts so much attention worldwide. Brands are falling over their feet to just be reflected in connection with this movement.
Yeah, just to associate with that,
That's right, and that's why you've got the rights holders, whether they're the Olympic Games or World Rugby or FIFA, the people who own the rights in the tournament, if I can call it that, will actually, the intellectual property rights, will license who can use their brands in whatever way. So it's actually a whole group of, it's not just a consideration of copyright, is the point that I want to make. It's actually a very nice example of how the different areas of intellectual property become involved. And in the end, when you have companies and corporates and organizations are all very well aware that you have to pay for use of recorded music, right? If you're, as a starting point, if you're a fashion store and around Christmas time you want to play the latest Christmas hit, you better make sure that you've got a license with Sanro in South Africa to make sure that you actually can do so without infringing rights. But the point is, it's nothing new. It's not surprising. That's why I'm sure a lot of the companies and organizations that Dumisani and his team will be making contact with in the coming months will actually probably make contact with them first to say, yeah, okay, you caught us. It's a sense of, you know, in this business, it's a risky business for a company or a corporate to align their brand with any movement where there's a commercial value to be extracted. And if you think about it, I've seen in the news a lot of reaction with respect to, you know, healthcare workers, dancing, how can they be, you know, thought about to pay license fees. But there's a huge difference between a group of people dressed up as nurses who are healthcare workers dancing and saying, we are healthcare workers in Germany or wherever. There's a big difference between that and all of a sudden a group of people dancing who are healthcare workers with a big brand behind them, whether it's a hospital. Right? Because why is it necessary for a particular hospital to say who they are and what their corporate identity is? If this is all in the spirit of togetherness, is it necessary to show your corporate identity, or do you believe it is important to show the world we are the best hospital in this country? We are the ones who are organized and maybe even showcase our beautiful grounds while we're at it. Each case will be considered on its own merits, but and then of course you've got the clear examples of like an airline that that is quite clearly a promotional video almost for the company. So I don't think it's actually even that difficult to determine where lines are crossed, you know, in a matter like this. But it is interesting that you can bet your bottom dollar whenever you have a massive event of global interest, you will have companies, individuals as well, who will look to actually plug into that massive interest, that customer, potential consumer base, or people where you can elevate your brand and just catch the lift to the top without doing what, you know, going through the traditional route of building your own brand reputation. And when you make that commercial interference, if I can call it that. And it's interesting to me that in the music business especially, maybe it's because music is available for free on so many of the online platforms. You know, billions of people click onto online platforms where they user upload platforms where they have access to music.
Listen, Stephen, I'm sorry to cut you short. I've got to take a break. And when we come back, I'll let you finish the point. We're back after this.
The Law Report on Kaya FM 95.9.
Welcome back. We're talking intellectual property, and joining me are Stephen Hollis, Chala Makhamate, as well as Dumzani Mutsamai. And you have any questions like Belita, you can give us a call, 086-000-959. Belita, good evening, and thank you very much for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good, and yourself?
I am good. I am very excited about the conversation going on tonight. Yeah. So I am a poet, first and foremost. I write, I teach writing and performance as well. And one of the biggest issues with just all the circles I've interacted with involved in poetry is everyone's trying to build an industry, you know? And it's like every generation has to start from scratch, and it makes it hard to maneuver because you have to make up the steps along the way, since there isn't a trail that we can follow. So I just want to understand with the intellectual property, how much attention is given, especially by Samo, to poetry that is shared. I found that with a lot of journals, which is, I think, the most interactive part of a poetry career, is you sending your work out to journals to get published, or publishing your own book. And marketing, like you guys said earlier, it's very easy for your work to become super popular, especially through social media. Mm-hmm. But with most of these journals, most of the spaces, social media counts as publishing. So I want to understand if that means that these social media companies have the right to whatever work I post to promote myself, and the spaces provided for poetry as an industry, as a copywriting part of the art.
Oh, that's actually a very interesting question. Thank you so much for that, Belita. You know, Chola, you were mentioned by name, but I think I'd like after you, Chola, anybody else, Stephen or Dumsan, just jump in, because I think there's so many layers to this question. Chola, will you take the first bite?
Okay, yeah. So there are a couple of layers. Remember, I think myself and also Stephen have mentioned that the Copyright Act provides for the protection of different types of work, right? And within that, for instance, in music, like I said, we deal with musical works and literary works, and SAMRO as an organization administers the public performance of those works for our members. Now, you are now talking about a different type of work that would be administered by a different collective management of organization. And if I heard you correctly, that your work would fall under a CMO called DAORU, the Dramatic Artistic Literary Rights Organization. We can give you those details or leave those with Michael to pass on. But essentially, they would be administering those rights for you. And in terms of when you put your works on particular platforms, I think you need to understand the terms and conditions of use for those different platforms, because sometimes people just put things up on YouTube, Facebook, et cetera, without understanding the terms and conditions of these. They will take out a license, the platforms with the different CMOs, but you need to not necessarily understand the details of those license agreements, but we would have an understanding and we would know what we were protecting or what we were administering in terms of that particular license agreement. So I think in terms of that, a more detailed conversation outside of this platform would be helpful for you with an organization like DAORU. They're very active in terms of rights protection, education, et cetera, and it would be good for you to just have a conversation with them about that in particular.
And maybe, Stephen, if you were going to take a bite at this question as well, I mean, there is something inherently difficult about this issue of the social media companies. I mean, think Facebook, think Twitter. I mean, Twitter shut down Trump, who had accumulated 80 million users. And this is not even before getting into the reasons that he might have had, but certainly the demonstration of the power that Twitter enjoys, where they can, you know, switch you off pretty much. And when we then talk about their terms of use, yes, they do ask you if you consent or not, but at a certain level, I'm not sure if a government asking you if you're consenting to something that they control and you don't have an alternative to, or monopolize and you don't have an alternative to it, they almost become governments unto themselves. I'm not sure if, you know, where are we headed in that interplay between those two? Between those two sort of things, where we can't ignore that Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and all of these guys are governments unto themselves, and for you to fight them. So Michael has no hope of starting an equivalent Facebook unless Michael's government in South Africa blocks Facebooks like China. You know, that's sort of where I'm headed. I don't know what you gentlemen think.
Well, Michael, just a quick comment from me on that one. Yes, I mean, some of these platforms are so powerful that they outmuscle financially even most countries around the world. So, so yes, they do have a powerful, market dominance. I think insofar as intellectual property protection on the platforms are concerned, it is difficult for any major and big user upload platform to ensure that no infringements occur.
Mm.
I think the responsibility on them exists to make sure that people's privacy are protected and respected, and personal information protection laws like we have in Poppy, recently introduced in South Africa fairly recently. And around the world, privacy laws are important, and also increased responsibility, I would say, to be placed on these platforms to ensure that, number one, infringements don't occur to begin with, and number two, to have effective systems in place to ensure that if infringement is notified, that it's swiftly addressed. And thirdly, important in the music business, to make sure that monetization from music that is played on these platforms, by placing advertisements around the platform so that the users themselves can listen to the music for free, that a bigger share of that reaches the pockets of the artists and creatives who are featured, because we know that that's a huge problem that has led to, maybe Chola can also speak to this, the value gap in the music business, which together with piracy is probably the biggest problem for the livelihoods of especially musicians. And that's what makes it so important for other revenue streams, like, for instance, the use of music in films, and also these license fees that Dumisani and his team are collecting, that they reach the artists, because traditional earning models have been decimated through free online usages.
I want to take this call, and I'm so excited about it, because Masekha tells me that we got a call from TK. He's Lucky Dube's son, a hero. And you know, he's well loved in South Africa, and many of us grew up listening to Lucky Dube. TK, good to be talking to you. Are you well?
I'm well, thank you. How are you,
man? Great, man. We loved your father's work, and thank you very much for calling in. What's going on?
So I think this is a very interesting topic, especially in the South African context, and I think a question that I had was, I think at this point in time, there's a lot of music coming out where there's a lot of sampling happening, and this is now not just in South Africa alone, obviously, it's globally, and I think for me, I just wanted to understand how far can one, go in terms of that sample without necessarily infringing on the rights of the creator of the original piece. Is there a set limit? You can copy the chorus or 20% of the chorus or something like that, if you're doing, if you're sampling the back track, how much of that back track can sound familiar to the original work without necessarily, infringing on the rights of the original creator?
All right, good question. Thank you very much. I'm not sure who wants to take that.
So...
I'm spoiled for choice, I'm sorry.
it's an interesting question, right? In our law as a center, right? You need to seek the permission of the creator of the original work, because you have what we call this the commercial rights, but you also have the moral rights which accrue to the creator. Those are also exclusive. So if you're going to change their original work, you need to seek their permission. Like I was saying earlier, in other jurisdictions, there are arguments around fair use, and this is where this becomes dangerous, is that how much of that work can I use before I actually need to get permission or I need to get a license for it. But where we sit now in South Africa with our law, you must get permission from the creator of the original work if you want to use that work and or adapt that work to create another work. Otherwise, you are infringing their copyright and they can take legal action against you.
Okay, so I've got sort of said thanks for that, TK. I've got six more minutes, and I just maybe wanted to use this time because I think a lot of people, when they get an opportunity to talk to a lawyer, half the time is what kind of advice can you give me? And I got three lawyers who's passionate about about intellectual property. Maybe if I can just give you just in 2 minutes each, Stephen, just your parting shot.
Thanks, Michael, and thanks everyone for tuned in. And I would say that, in the music business, I think we often look at the commercial side of things, but a piece of recorded music is a commercial and corporate asset.
Mm-hmm.
It's a commercial and corporate asset that is owned by the artists, and it's owned by the companies who invest in those artists and who invest in creating the best top quality sound recordings that the world can enjoy. And I must say, I'm often quite surprised that in the music business, it seems like the only business where users seem to think that it is completely acceptable to take someone else's corporate and commercial asset and use it without their permission. This is not an industry where it's better to ask for forgiveness than to ask for permission. This is actually, and what I would like to call for is a bigger corporate responsibility to be better corporate responsible citizen, and to actually, before making use of recorded music, think about actually where that license fee is going to go. It's going to go to the artist. It's going to go to the people who invest in the artist, and that will incentivize the creation of the very works that we continue to demand and want to enjoy. So I think let's actually focus on, I think there's a huge opportunity, and Jerusalem has shown the way, that it's possible for corporates who, you don't have to be a recording company to invest in an artist or in a movement. You can actually join the party, but make sure you're licensed to do so. Make sure you support it. And there's more opportunities for companies to go to recording companies and publishers and their artists and say, we want you to be our brand ambassador for this, or we want you to be aligned with this project where we can align our brand. So rather start building the right licensing structures with the help of CMOs like Samro and with the help of recording labels, and let's elevate our artists.
Sure, Stephen. Stephen, I'm out of your 2 minutes. Sign a quick shot for us, please. Your parting.
No, line. I think Hollis has said it all. Hey?
Yeah.
Hollis
okay. Great.
Said it all. He's summed it quite.
Okay. Awesome. Chola, yours. I am literally just left with a minute, and I just think that there's so much to learn, and I just want to make sure that often when I get interviewed, I'm like, geez, they should have asked me this. Yeah.
I think just quickly, we are dealing with COVID, and the impact of COVID has been disastrous. It's decimated the creative industry in particular, and the music sector has suffered. The recovery thereof will be slow, long, and painful. And I just think people should be mindful of the fact that when you use someone's works, when you play their music, listen to their music, and you don't pay for it, right, there's an impact. There are people like you. They have to pay for school fees. They have to pay for rent. They have to pay for food. They have to pay for a lot of things. And already COVID and the regulations have hampered their ability to do so. No live performances. Restaurant hours are shorter. That means licensing fee structures have had to change drastically to accommodate that, which means their earning potential has reduced. So where you can, take out a license. If you're not sure about whether you need a license or not, reach out to organizations like SAMRO, CAPASO, SAMPRA. There are many of us out there so that you can get a definitive answer, so that you can support our artists. And it's great that Master KG has been able to do this, and he has the support that he has, but not everybody. And there are many of those in the music industry who have that support.
100%. Well, thank you so much to all of my guests, Chola Mahamate, Stephen Hollis, as well as Dumsani Mutamai. And most of all, thank you to you, the Afropolitan, for tuning in and for spending your Wednesday evening with us. We know you could have been anywhere in the world, but you chose to be with us. Thank you very much. Until next Wednesday, good night.
Rewinding Kaya FM on FM Rewind. Visit kayafm.co.za for more.